I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. This week, Stephen and I discuss the prospect of a government of national unity. You ask us how no-deal Brexit will affect our everyday lives. And I speak to Emily Bootle about whether the comedy panel show has had its day.
So, welcome back from Croatia.
Thank you.
While you were gone, a particularly silly bout of summer stories has hit Westminster. There is a new plan, in heavy inverted commas around the word plan, and indeed around the word new, to stomp a no-deal Brexit, which is to form a caretaker government, that's the phrase Jeremy Corbyn prefers, an emergency government, that's the phrase that Jo Swinson has been using, or a government of national unity, or a GNU, which seems to be the kind of like phrase that people have been using the most, to stop a no-deal Brexit by extending Article 50 so there could be an election slash a referendum slash another extension when Parliament decides and it hates all of the possible resolutions to Brexit.
Right, okay. It's not exactly a fun summer silly story, is it?
So it's odd because I've gone through, there was a stage when I was very much in a kind of where the whole thing was annoying me so much that I was literally in a kind of like, I just need to find a paper bag and scream into it kind of stage.
Yeah.
And now I actually, to be honest, do find it quite funny.
I'm trying to think of some kind of, do GNUs bury their heads in the sand like ostriches? Because that's like the only image that's really in my head now.
I mean,
and it's very appropriate because, like you, and I know it's quite boring when we agree on things, but it sounds utterly ridiculous to me how you could have a national unity government when the one thing defining the government in the Brexit era is a lack of unity.
So I'll talk through my kind of stages of grief while you were away.
I'm sad I wasn't here to witness this.
So the bag stage, I think, was, and I'm aware that I'm saying this in very much biting the hand that feeds, right? But there is a chunk of Remainers who, I'm honestly astonished, don't spend all of their time buying bridges. There's just something about, like, kind of Remain political organising, particularly online, that just seems to encourage people to gravitate around inherently implausible ideas, right? Mm. So first it was this idea that the Labour Party had a secret plan to stop Brexit. Then it was, like, weirdly, I kind of feel like a lot of those Remainers have ended up in the right position vis-a-vis Labour, but their journey to get there is based on this strange idea that Labour has a button it could press and not on any of the actual things Labour has actually done that they might be annoyed by. And then that same group of people has kind of seized on this idea of a government of national unity. And in each one of these ideas has in common that someone kind of has sort of semi-mooted them in a kind of like, let's take these people for a ride. And then, like, it kind of enters the Remain ecosystem and it just won't leave.
Yeah.
And I think there's just something deeply maddening also about this way that you can only get Remainers to accept that a plan is implausible when they will use it to argue in favour of another implausible plan. You know, this kind of like, okay, I accept that a government of national unity is unlikely, but it's less unlikely than the Conservatives providing the majority for a referendum. And it's just like, I mean, that's true, but only in the same sense than it is more implausible that I will die by being sucked into a black hole than it is that I will die by being exposed to the vacuum of space. Both of those things are so so unlikely in terms of the context of, you know, my profession, my life, my income, etc., etc. You know, so that was kind of the paper bag stage. Why is this ridiculous idea being taken remotely seriously? Then I guess the bags thing really accelerated, actually, when... So the beginning of the government of national unity was during the Liberal Democrat leadership election. It was a way for supporters of Ed Davey to go, oh, you know, we might be called upon to be in this government of national unity. You know, it would be really important if the leader of the Liberal Democrats had been a Secretary of State. Hands up if you've been a Secretary of State. Keep your hand down.
Hands up, one thing different and slightly better than our rival. Yeah,
yeah. And it was like, you know, like kind of this desperate search for differentiation. And obviously it was a silly idea then, and it visibly did not have the desired effect.
But I forgive that idea slightly of the Lib Dems, because they have to say silly ideas to get headlines, right? They have to say a few mad things so that people pay attention to them. I'll just slip that in there.
I mean, I think in an odd way, actually, all of the things that various political parties have said about the government of national unity, I'm entirely forgiving of, right? Mm-hmm. Like Caroline Lucas going, oh, you know, my plan for a government of national unity is a government of national unity, but all of the protagonists are women. Like,
yeah,
it doesn't change the fundamental problem, which is that you cannot put that combination of MPs together. It's an impossible... Yeah, it's like a weird maths puzzle where whatever happens, you cannot get the values to sum to 325. Mm. What if they're all women doesn't change the basic problem of getting the numbers to add up to 325.
Yeah.
But, like, fair play. It's in the same way that, you know, Jeremy Corbyn's letter going, oh, well, actually, I'm happy to head a caretaker administration, was purely about taking a stick that was being used to beat him and using it to beat other people.
Yeah.
I kind of think I have absolutely no problem with political parties behaving in a way that puts their political interests first. I guess the kind of in the bag stage, the two sources of my need to scream in a bag were one, that it works, right? The BBC put Caroline Lucas's call for a government of national unity of all women on its homepage, literally on the most read news site in the United Kingdom, and it took until the ninth paragraph before it was criticised, and the criticism was Liz Truss going, isn't this a bit sexist? It's just like, now...
That is not... Of all the criticism...
It's just like, it literally, like, it would like... It's just one of the things, just like, isn't the bigger thing that the BBC should have arguably informed its readers of some time ago that... This has no chance of happening. You know, like...
No, the problem is the underrepresentation of white middle-aged men at the top of politics.
Yeah, it's just like one of those things where it's like, it was genuinely easier to find out than Caroline Lucas's idea had been criticised from the right on the grounds of its lack of men, from the left on the grounds of its lack of diversity. I'm not saying that those two criticisms are necessarily completely... they are completely flawed in the same way that, you know, if I said, oh, I'm planning to turn my spare room into a multicoloured jacuzzi, there might be reasons to oppose that, but I also don't have a spare room. The central conceit is fundamentally not worth anyone's time or energy. And I think that was the point when I was just like, I cannot believe that our national broadcaster, which has a huge role in our, you know, in our political discourse, in our media ecosystem, has decided that it is going to put this proposal front and centre and treat it as if, considering, you know, and kind of looking ahead in terms of, you know, what you'll be telling us about in the next segment, I just think in terms of what might happen to the country on the 1st of November, I do have serious objections to the complete failure of a large chunk of our political media, i.e. the BBC, to remotely prepare people for the idea that might happen. It literally would be like if the coverage during the financial crisis was like, what does this mean for Gordon Brown's ability to hold off James Purnell? I feel like there's probably a more important... they don't even necessarily need to be things which might happen. The other thing which is causing me in my kind of, oh my God, I need this paper bag stage, was just the madness of the fact that when it was being used as a stick to beat Corbyn with, a bunch of people correctly were going, come on, guys, the numbers for this cannot be made to add up with any leaders. Are you having a bubble? And then watching those same people literally in real time start going, oh, well, you know, Joe Swinson saying that it won't ever work and that that this is a ridiculous proposal is being ridiculous. And it's just like one of those things where it's just like, guys...
You can't think both of those things at the same time.
You cannot possibly... I mean, okay, obviously people can convince themselves of partisan things all the time, but just... for some reason, it really got to me. But then it just became hilarious to me. Right? Like we are 75 or however many days it is from leaving the European Union without a deal. And a large number of people are seriously arguing about whether or not, you know, they could form a government, but they don't have the votes, but if a friend of a friend does. You know, and they're all just based on ludicrous premises, right? Like, the 11 people who have left the Labour Party because they do not believe Jeremy Corbyn should be Prime Minister, particularly important on this issue for national security reasons, are going to go, yes, I'm happy for him to chair the National Security Council for 6 weeks. Why not? That's definitely going to be my last act before I'm defeated in an election. the idea that the leader of the Labour Party is going to go, why, yes, I do want to kick off an election by announcing to our Leave voters that I think no-deal Brexit is terrible, but 11 people who used to be in my own party think that I am even worse. I mean, like, every point of it requires you to believe that someone is going to take stupid pills, right? There is literally no part of it as an idea that isn't hilariously demented, and that's why I'm now in this kind of, like, wow. I mean, people took the time to track down Ken Clark to find out if he wanted to be in the government.
Bigger picture, and goes back to what you were saying about the BBC, I think these kind of ideas are a result of how lots of the mainstream Brexit coverage has been obsessed with personality throughout the whole thing. So I don't know about you, but when I speak to people behind the scenes who are more on the Remain side of things, usually they're obsessed with cherry picking the personalities that they would like to be in charge of Brexit, or rather stopping Brexit. So, you know, someone who's quite high up, a Remain sort of establishment Labour politician, was saying, oh, you know, I'd have Hillary Benn here, Tom Watson here, Ken Clark here, you know, all of these characters. And it's like, first of all, what do you want them to be doing? How would you get them all together working in the same kind of party or system? And the obsession with personality is so irrelevant, particularly when Parliament is so sort of fractured, that I think that obsession has culminated in this sort of dream kind of fantasy football type style of looking at government.
Yeah, so Raphael Hogarth, you wrote a very good piece about how you could actually prevent no deal, i.e. legislation, in prospect. I reached him to talk about it, and he said you can audibly hear the sigh of relief from large chunks of Fleet Street and Westminster whenever the conversation moves away from Brexit policy and legislative options towards... What's
Yvette Cooper doing?
Yeah, I know I've said this before, but I continue to be hugely fascinated by effectively the fictional character of Yvette Cooper in in, like, Remain mythology, right? This is someone who has not said that they are pro-referendum, who likened opposing triggering Article 50 to being like Donald Trump, you know, who has consistently... Like, it is essentially impossible to sustain the argument that her Brexit position is qualitatively different from Jeremy Corbyn's, right? She'll talk up slightly different aspects of it, you know, like free movement, and why it needs to end, or whereas Jeremy Corbyn is more likely to talk about the European court. Yet, it's not like Yvette Cooper is herself doing anything to trick these people, right? It feels essentially identical to, again, this same group of people, the level of hope they would invest in Jeremy Corbyn when he'd give a speech being like, I think that we would do Brexit better. There was a referendum, and like a bunch of like people would go, actually, I think what you don't understand is that he is really into stopping Brexit. And that same group of people are now doing the exact same thing to Yvette Cooper. And I feel like if we could understand, and again, I know we've said this before, but like, if you were to pick a member of the parliamentary party at random, you would have more chance of picking someone who wants to stop Brexit and has voted to stop Brexit than this weird cosplaying of let's have a government and I'm going to somehow manage to consistently name politicians. What is this? Is it some weird kink? Where does it come from?
The naming of the politicians.
Yeah, and this the whole thing is just entertainingly crazy. Of course, the problem is that we are still 79 days from no deal, which will be the topic of our next segment.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So now it's time for a section we like to call...
You Ask Us.
Indeed. This is a kind of question that lots of people are asking, including myself, which is basically like, what would No Deal look like? Anoush, you've been heading up our Know Your No Deal section. So yeah, what does happen if we do leave on the 31st of October without a deal?
Okay, well, yeah, we've been running this series. You can find it online. It's called Know Your No Deal. And it's basically asking, how will No Deal Brexit affect our lives in all the different areas? So the common questions that we've been asked are, you know, will there be medicine shortages? Will there be food shortages? What will happen to the pound? What will happen to the economy? But we also have other really interesting pieces, like, does the public actually want a No Deal Brexit? So you often get Brexiteer politicians or politicians who represent Leave seats saying everyone wants a no-deal Brexit. Actually, Joe Twyman, the pollster, has debunked that slightly, although there's not much enthusiasm on any other alternative as well. So that's worth a read. And we've also had a piece about how potentially bans will be put off coming to play in the UK and vice versa. UK bands going to play in European countries, because in particular it makes it difficult for them to transport their instruments. And we've also got a great piece about how the culture of our diets could change and we could go back to a more sort of English diet, which is actually quite a terrifying piece if you want to have a read. Ultimately, the baseline of all of the pieces is that it's really difficult to tell how things will be affected, because we're not sure how much businesses are actually following the government's guidance for creating contingency plans, and we're not sure how far the government's contingency plans are actually adequate. I mean, all the reporting recently has shown probably not adequate at all. Most recently, I've been working on a piece with someone who's a heart transplant patient, and he's terrified of No Deal because the drugs that he takes, if he misses them, he dies because his body starts rejecting his heart. So he's very concerned, obviously, about that. And he hasn't had a single message from the government, the NHS, his GP, his consultants about whether or not medication like his will be affected. So that's something that we've been working on, speaking to the Department of Health about that issue. So that's really worth a read. That's coming out this week. And in terms of other pieces, I mean, the ones about the economy are probably the ones which are the least clear, actually. So we've had quite a few economists look at the issue for us. And the big debate is that similar for businesses, is how much a weaker pound, the positives of a weaker pound for a business that is exporting, will outweigh the negatives of what's going on back in the UK and the cost of importing things, and also what happens to their labour force as well. So unfortunately, it's not a very easy question to answer, but no matter, you know, whether you're for or against, it is going to profoundly change the country.
Yeah, so basically the kind of essential problem, right, is that you leave and you drop out of the regulatory and trading sort of architecture that the United Kingdom has existed in for 40 years, and there is then immediate disruption, and it's not clear what the immediate effects of that disruption are.
Exactly, yeah. It's not clear what those effects are. I mean, we're doing a series within this series speaking to business owners who are telling them their sort of Brexit diaries. How much are they actually preparing for No Deal? How much are they taking it seriously? How far can they actually, even if they want to prepare? And, you know, the people that we've spoken to so far, while they did vaguely stockpile in a lacklustre way before March some of their products or their raw materials that they needed, they just used them immediately after the deadline was extended. So that's making it a little bit difficult to take this new October the 31st deadline seriously, because it costs money to do that. And if you're a small business with tight margins and, you know, very tight cash flow, then you can't afford to keep doing that. And I think that's one of the biggest problems, because the government's basically leaning on business to prepare.
Yeah, I think like one of the things the thing I find interesting about that is when you speak to people in Whitehall and you go like, well, what would it look like? The thing they always say is, well, we don't know, because we don't know whether or not there will be consumer panic.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're like, we don't have any lever that we can pull to compel businesses, because the way you'd compel businesses is through legislation. And if you had legislation to compel businesses, then Parliament would have an opportunity to go, yeah, don't do that, don't do no deal. But they were saying the other problem is, and basically they have kind of like two globs of people who won't prepare, who can. The ones who are like, that's really expensive, none of our competitors are doing it, and we think Dominic Grieve will stop it.
Yeah.
And another glob who go, yeah, I think it's all Project Fear, it'll be fine. And of course, there is no message for both of those groups. But if either of them continue to just be like, we think it'll be fine, we don't have a no deal contingency plan, then of course that is another kind of known unknown.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head of the problem. It's a dilemma, really, for the government, because on the one hand, you know, every time you go to a government department for comment, they'll be like, it's all in train, it will all be fine, things will carry on as usual, this is our plan. But because they're saying that, businesses, like you say, are thinking, oh, it's all Project Fear, actually it's going to be fine, or they just feel comforted by what the government's saying. And so those two things at the same time mean that you're not getting the outcome that you want from people preparing. So I found this in the piece that I wrote about medical supplies and medicines. So one of the major problems will be medicines getting through, but one of the biggest problems there is the panic, is people stockpiling. People are already starting to panic and stockpile, and pharmacies are running low on supplies. That's, you know, that's one of the biggest issues there. And so if the government wants to try and comfort them and say, no, no, please don't panic, but at the same time, it's telling pharmaceutical companies to stockpile. So, you know, those two things are contradictory and could result in the worst possible scenario, which is people panicking.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of one of the sort of kind of conversations, yeah, that kind of like at a Westminster end that kind of keep happening is, yeah, well, who will be blamed? And my underlying assumption, which is, you know, like, is I, although I kind of accept, you know, intellectually, then it's plausible, then there's, you know, there's some blame that goes round for everyone. I kind of just feel like governments get blamed for so much stuff which isn't their fault. I mean, like the Interrail thing, which was purely a quango going, well, we've decided to have a ridiculous show of strength. And the second that an elected politician got involved at all, it was to go, whoa, no, 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 you have to reverse this decision, which is really bad for the tourism industry outside of London.
Yeah.
You are going to U-turn today. But the government still got blamed for that very short-lived opting out of Interrailing, not for people in the UK to use, but for people coming to the UK to use, which is why it was so particularly angering to British tourism, because that means essentially that someone on an Interrail pass goes, okay, well, I'll come to London, but if my Interrail train is not included, you know, in my train to York, well, I'm not going to the Rail Museum, I'm not going to et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
The government got blamed for that, which wasn't their fault, and they fixed in a matter of hours. I just find the idea that if any of this bad stuff actually happens, people are going to go, oh, actually, I have a complex view about Corbyn's open letter and the gif that Joe Swinson tweeted in response. I just don't buy it.
Yeah, I don't buy it. I think obviously the government will try and position the EU as the villains if no deal is as disastrous as we think that it will be. How likely do you think it will be able to cast them as the villains? I don't think so, because we will have left by then. And that some of the consequences, lots of the most disastrous consequences will be short term, but some of them will carry on into the long term. And that's when the government will really suffer.
I kind of think, one, I think I'm always struck by the fact, and I think there's actually quite a large number of people who kind of basically expect the EU to look after their people and its end of the negotiation. They believe that the government can stand up to the EU. Yeah, I mean, in many ways, I kind of think actually the government already has a problem with unreasonable expectations, which it itself has also stoked up, that it is encouraging people to believe that our trade negotiations with the EU and indeed with the US will be engaged on as equals, right? Like, there's this kind of like inability to go, look, you can have the regulatory freedoms of a Canada, but that also means that you negotiate with the weaknesses of a Canada-sized economic unit. There is an inherent trade-off there. I kind of just think basically people will, they like, although they might say, well, I blame the EU and the government, well, they can't vote against the EU.
Exactly.
We won't be in it anymore. I mean, like that.
Also, how can you cast yourself as a villain and as plucky, optimistic Britain at the same time? You know, it's one or the other.
Yeah, and I think that's the weird structural problem here, right, is that the government has done so much building up of expectations. And I can't really work out how, like, it's no deal message is basically like, Don't worry, we're working hard on it. Politicians don't get to cancel the votes and they don't like. And then, like, people are all gloomsters. And you're just like, well, okay, but which one of those lines are you planning to use if on day two there's, like, a, you know, a riot on a, you know, a traffic jam, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's the other, like, yeah, like, so, yeah, is traffic one of the... what will happen at ports?
Yeah,
will
I mean, that's one of the big questions. And also, yeah, that will be one of the most sort of immediate flashpoints.
So this has been a cheerful conversation.
Yeah. I'm now joined by Emily Bootle, who usually sits here and winces at Stephen and my conversation for half an hour each week recording our podcast. But she's written a very good piece about the comedy panel show and whether it's had its day. So why did you decide to write on this topic, first of all?
So I decided to write about this because I basically got sick of flicking through channels after work and finding endless reruns of QI on Dave and just thinking about how when I was growing up, the panel show seemed like the peak of comedy.
Yeah.
And I felt like it's had its day, as the headline says. So I thought I'd kind of look into it and see if it actually has had its day. And it seems it hasn't. So that was an interesting...
That's interesting, because I do think there's a tendency now, particularly in sort of the current climate, which everyone always uses to refer to what we're going through, that like it's impossible to have political satire anymore because everything's so sort of apocalyptic and unbelievable anyway.
Yeah.
And I think we've run actually a piece by Armando Iannucci saying that before at the New Statesman. So like the idea of having a political sort of banter show like... Have I Got News For You? It seems kind of passé, especially when all the jokes are made on Twitter that day.
Exactly. Well, the Twitter thing is really interesting because, again, I think for me, I felt that a lot of these takes were just happening in real time on Twitter. So the idea of having half an hour every week dedicated to analysing the news just seems a little bit dated in a way because, you know, some of the stuff will have happened 5 days ago.
Yeah.
But actually, I think that might be symptomatic of me and lots of the people that I know being in a bit of a bubble where we're on Twitter all the time. And actually, I interviewed Ian Hislop for the piece who had a lot of thoughts about it. And he was kind of like, most people aren't on Twitter all day.
Yeah.
And also, most people on Twitter aren't that funny. don't have a particularly clever take compared to some of the people on panel shows. But the other thing about the internet is that it supposedly gives people an equal platform to have those takes, whereas panel shows are famously very undiverse. So that was the other thing that the piece was kind of talking
about. So do they remain undiverse then?
Yeah, they are kind of shockingly undiverse, actually. So there was somebody's put together a list of the gender percentage breakdowns for panel shows, and the worst one is I'm sorry I haven't a clue on Radio 4, which the all-time appearances, so including regulars and hosts, only 3.6% have been women.
Wow.
Which is, I just thought that was unbelievable. And then even so QI is hosted by Sandy Toksvig, who is a woman, and that's still only 19.8% of all-time appearances have been women, which I think is quite shocking for a format that ostensibly is supposed to be about giving lots of people an opportunity to have their say. You know, that's the point of a panel show. It's a panel.
Yeah, exactly. Especially as panel shows are supposed to kind of be sort of popping the balloon of the establishment kind of thing. If
exactly.
they just reflect the establishment, that's quite ironic.
Exactly. And yeah, I guess the other thing that I talked about in the piece is the idea of reflecting the establishment, because Have I Got News For You has political figures or politicians on quite a lot. And recently, since Boris Johnson sort of entered the Conservative leadership election, there's been quite a lot of criticism directed at Have I Got News For You because he's hosted it a few times. And so, yeah, that's kind of interesting in terms of how relevant they are, because they do have some sway in the public's perception of things.
Yeah.
Because Boris Johnson was, even though Ian Hislop says he criticised him and he's not a fan of Boris Johnson, he was still given this platform with entertainers. He was kind of amongst the banter just by nature of what the program is like.
Mm.
And so,
and you're allowed to sort of, from knowing people who have gone on that show, you're allowed to sort of take the time to come up with your own jokes before you go on. So.
Yeah, exactly. So there have been a lot of people who have said that Have I Got News For You really propelled Boris Johnson's career.
Mm. And what was Ian Hislop's response to that?
Ian Hislop just said that he tried to criticise Boris Johnson when he was on the programme, and that, you know, the idea of having politicians on Have I Got News For You is to critique them, I suppose, or question them. And I think Ian Hislop did that. And since Boris Johnson became Mayor of London and his career grew, I think they've sort of maintained their criticism of him. But
The thing is, how do you distinguish that as a viewer? How do you distinguish that criticism from all of the guests that they have on, or the guest hosts that they have on? Because they're always poking fun at them and they're poking fun at each other. So how do you distinguish poking fun at Boris Johnson from poking fun at Ian Hislop?
Yeah, you know? Exactly. And I mean, but also the other thing that Ian Hislop said was, you don't want to get into this situation where you can't have certain people on television because you don't agree with them. And I know that kind of gets into a bit of a dangerous free speech debate, but I guess he's got a point. You can't just get left-wing politicians on because that's the general stance of Have I Got News For You. You have to, I hate to say, you have to give Boris Johnson a chance, but you have to have some consistency.
Yeah, okay. And so in terms of viewing and listening figures then, are these kind of shows still sort of...
Yeah, so they still, I mean, they've gone down since sort of 10 years ago, like I said, but I think the approval ratings are still pretty high for them generally. So my initial wanting to prove their demise didn't really come to fruition in the piece, but I think that's interesting in itself, really.
Well, what was interesting about watching Love Island this summer was the advert breaks. There were so many comedy panel shows advertised in those breaks. Celebability and is there one called Hey Tracy so is there sort of like a proliferation of other panel shows, comedy panel shows, that aren't quite in the same vein as, you know, the news quiz or Have I Got News For You?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think there's always that gap to fill, right, of just totally absurd humour with sort of Z-list celebrities. But, you know, in a way, things like Celebability are okay in that normally we see these people on Instagram living idealistic lives, and it's kind of quite good to see them not take themselves so seriously once in a while. And it's kind of interesting that the panel show has so many different iterations, as well as that quite, as we've talked about, influential political stuff. It's got the just completely irrelevant nonsense of like Scarlett Moffat, I don't know, like pouring water on her own head or something.
I know which I'd rather watch.
Yeah.
So what was the conclusion of your piece then?
I think the conclusion of the piece is just they do still have relevance. They do still have popularity. And so it's even more important that the comedy industry makes an effort to get more diverse voices in there and use the panel format to its maximum potential, basically. And, you know, TV channels are doing that. The BBC several years ago banned all male panels.
Mm.
ITV has recently banned all male writers' rooms. So, you know, and Ian Hislop talked about how they're sort of, they do everything they can to try and diversify. So, you know, there is some effort being made, but I think the take home is just that they're still on TV, so they need to be up to date.
Thanks so much and great piece.
Oh,
everyone should read it who's listening to this segment. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shakelian, and Stephen Bush. We're recorded by Emily Bootle and produced by Nick Hilton, and our music is Devil by the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.